Welcome to Periodical Radio, the program about magazines and journals. I'm your host, Steve Black, librarian at the College of St. Rose in Albany, New York, and author of the book Serials in Libraries, Issues and Practices. This installment of Periodical Radio is about Film History, an international journal. This quarterly scholarly journal is published jointly by Indiana University Press and John Libby Publishing. Film History publishes research on the historical development of motion pictures in the context of society, technology, and the economy. To quote from the journal's statement of aims and scope, Film History's content ranges from the technical and entrepreneurial innovations of early and pre-cinema experiments through all aspects of the production, distribution, exhibition, and reception of commercial and non-commercial motion pictures. Most issues of film history are devoted to a single theme. Recent themes include film museums, women and the silent screen, 1927, local film, and the intriguingly titled Unfashionable, Overlooked, or Underestimated. Each issue begins with an introduction, which I found myself drawn to in order to learn why 1927 was a theme, or what the term local film means. The provocative first line of the introduction to the 1927 theme is, "This issue is dedicated to saving 1927 from the jazz singer." Apparently, the first talkie was not the only significant accomplishment that year. And I learned that local films shot in a community, and shown in only that community, were often funded by local cinema owners to boost attendance. Each issue of Film History runs approximately 130 pages. As is typical with scholarly journals, each volume begins with page one, and pagination continues through the volume. So issue two may begin with page 130, issue three with page 260, and so on, so page numbers run through the full volume as they do in a book. Film History is printed in black and white on high-quality glossy white paper. The sharply printed text is divided in two columns. Many articles include illustrations from films, old advertisements, or historical photographs. These are reproduced as crisply as the originals allow. Film History is indexed in America History and Life, and articles from the journal are available in several full-text databases, including Project Muse, EBSCOhost's Communication and Mass Media Complete, InfoTrack OneFile, and ProQuest 5000. The subscription price for Film History is $175 for libraries and $70 for individuals. A price difference for libraries and individuals is typical for scholarly journals. To learn more about Film History, I have as my guest Editor-in-Chief Richard Kozarski, Associate Professor in the Department of English at Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. Richard, welcome to Periodical Radio.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
In a nutshell, what is Film History about?
Well, anyone can sort of turn to the back of the journal where we have our aims and scope. And for many years, we've published our scope as being the historical development of motion pictures within their social and technological and economic context, which means that it's not a journal devoted to old films or reviews of old films, but it uses films themselves as entry points into the history of this medium, so that we've never published a review of Citizen Kane, you know, or a review of a movie like Sunrise or The Battleship Potemkin, but often articles are either bouncing off those films or going through those films to discuss larger issues, which affect the entire moving image industry in many different ways.
I'd like to ask a basic question about terminology. Why is the term film used rather than cinema or movies or motion pictures?
Well, that goes back to where the journal came from. About 1985, I was approached by some people who were working with Taylor and Francis. And Taylor and Francis were publishing a journal called History of Photography. And they said, we'd like you to edit a journal for us called History of Film. And I thought, well, History of Film, that doesn't... So we flipped it around and it became Film History. The suggestion, I guess, was theirs. And, of course, it's neater than, you know, motion pictures. I think it was simply shorter for them. Motion pictures already in the 1980s seemed to be too limited to photochemical-based media as opposed to electronic media or what we now think of as 19th century pre-cinema media. And history of cinema would have sounded maybe a little too continental. I think they wanted something that was going to seem a little punchier and a little more American, actually. So we wound up with film history. And film history is a term that pops up a lot in the literature. I mean, there are books that call themselves, you know, film history and approach to film history. And we were there early, I guess, with that.
Each issue of Film History addresses a theme. How do you choose the themes?
We have a group of associate editors. And these editors include people from all over the world. We have people like Stephen Bottomore, who's an independent historian living in, now he's living in Thailand. He'd been living in London previously. John Fullerton from Stockholm. We have Janet Bergstrom from UCLA. And also John Belton and Daniel Lieb, who teach here in New Jersey, where I do. And each of these editors is sort of given the responsibility to locate one of these themes, to find a theme. What are you interested in developing? What will you? What do you want to work on? Now, if you look over a year or two of the journal, you'll say, well, there are sometimes there are issues that, you know, aren't edited by these people, or somebody gets to do two issues, or you do two issues, Richard. We, you know, are also amenable to being approached with suggestions from the outside for particular issues. So we have an issue now that's going to press. It will be edited by Charles Musser, who was an early cinema specialist, and Charlie Musser wanted to do something on documentary film in the 1920s and 30s, and we've been working with him, and that's coming along very well. That should be out by the end of the year. Then there's another category, and we do accept also papers submitted that are off topic. Somebody sends me a paper, and it says a wonderful piece of work. I can't say, well, we really don't have anything coming up on this field. I guess we'll just have to toss it back. So we can do one of two things with that. We can add it on to a journal that maybe has a little space, an issue that has a little space left over. Because after all, these are magazine issues. They're not anthologies. They're not, you know, hardcover book anthologies. So I think we have a little flexibility there. Or we can gather them together. And if we see that we're beginning to have a shape emerging from these submissions, which is often not surprising because people tend to be interested in writing about the same things. There are waves of interest over time that seem to appeal to writers. These can coalesce and form an issue. We did this recently. You mentioned to me earlier our issue on overlooked and unknown topics.
Yes, I believe the exact title was Unfashionable, Overlooked, or Underestimated.
Yes.
Tell us about what was in that issue.
Well, what was in that issue, which is not exactly in front of me, is one of these assortments of papers that have come in over a year, 15 months, and I'll look at this and I'll say, see, this is really nice. Can I hold on to this and see if we have some space? More things come in, and I can either say, well, here are some nice things that came in over the transom, or from what's available there, what has not been solicited. And this has only happened once or twice, but this is one example. I say, there's something linking all this material. All this material is away from or off the point of many of the obvious suspects in terms of film historical research today. So what I have to do then is write an introduction which justifies it and explains this.
I read your introduction to that issue, and there's also an article in that issue that you wrote about the 1918 flu pandemic. I found it very interesting. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about that flu outbreak and how it affected the motion picture industry?
At the end of the First World War, there is a epidemic of, or a pandemic now, of what they call Spanish influenza. And this epidemic of Spanish influenza begins apparently in the United States, moves to England with troops that we're sending over there, then winds up sweeping around the world, comes back to the United States later in 1918. And I had been reading books about the flu epidemic that had been published in the last half dozen years. Probably it's not coincidental that these books are written, you know, under the shadow of the looming bird flu epidemic. Fine, so people are writing about this. And I'm thinking, what, you know, didn't this have some impact in motion pictures? Because they were one or two anecdotes you'd encounter periodically in someone's autobiography. You know, we had to wear flu masks when we made that film. And I'm saying, well, how come, you know, I don't hear more about this, especially if it was going to such an extent that entire towns were being closed down or were closing down their business establishments and so on. So I began researching it, possibly with the idea of doing a book. I still may do a book on this topic. And I said, let's go and so we'll do a we'll drill a hole, you know, a sample hole in one journal. And the journal we looked at, it was Moving Picture World, which is an easy to access journal. And I said, well, we'll go through Moving Picture World, which is basically devoted to the exhibitors and talks more about theaters, what's going on in the towns across the country, as opposed to talking about what's happening inside the studios. And by going through the Moving Picture World for this period and simply reprinting excerpts in chronological order of a selection of the hundreds of pieces that the World published over 4 or 5 months, I was able to sort of chart the flow of this epidemic from the East Coast, where it started here in Boston, from the East Coast until it expired in December of 18, early 1919, on the West Coast. And as this epidemic progressed, you could see that initially the theater owners were felt very patriotic. You know, they had been patriotic during the war, raising money for war bonds. Yes, we, you know, we will close you know, this week because the epidemic is here. Then the epidemic would last longer. It would go on 2 weeks. And they'd say, no, 3 weeks you have to be closed. 4 weeks you have to have your theater closed. And people began to suffer financially terribly, especially in something like the motion picture industry, where if you don't get someone's money that day, they're not going to come back next month. I mean, if you need a pair of shoes, you can delay a week or two buying them, but movies are an instantaneous purchase. So every week that these theaters are closed, they basically lose that revenue. So at first, you find the theater folks responding by making common cause with other institutions that had been closed, such as saloons and, in some places, churches. That is, some municipalities ordered theaters, saloons, and churches closed. Department stores, usually not. You know, transportation lines, usually not. And sometimes, in some towns, saloons would be allowed to be open, but churches would be closed. So you have reason for all sorts of people to be making common cause and complaining about a sort of irrational application. Eventually, by the end of 1918, some theater owners are going to court, and they're about to bring what would have been sort of precedent-making legal actions against the ability of the government, even in time of war or emergency, to put them arbitrarily out of business. These cases were moot as the epidemic expired and were never, were never adjudicated. But what I thought was interesting here is, well, maybe this bird flu epidemic will be coming, and what are we going to do about, well, in our case, it's a hit film history journal, the movie business. Are the theaters going to cooperate the way they initially did in 1918, or are we going to see a legal bloodbath, which is what looked as if it was about to happen at the end of 1918?
Richard, I'd like to ask you a few questions about your job as editor-in-chief of Film History. How did you become editor-in-chief?
In about 1985, I was approached by a publisher working with Taylor & Francis, a large journals publisher, to begin work on this magazine that they wanted to be a sort of a brother of their history of photography. And we began developing this journal, which became called not History of Film, but Film History. But there were problems. Initially, there were problems because history of photography, if you look at the not only the articles, but the editorial board, is tied largely to museums, libraries, archives, and collectors. Those are the main people who are supporting that sort of historical work in the medium. In the movie business, the film scholarship business doesn't work that way. In fact, there were no real sort of film museums in 1985 the way you have several around the world today. You had archives. You had libraries that had some material. Collectors of movies did not operate the way collectors of photographs did. There was no art market for motion picture prints. And what historical work was being done, say by 1980, was not coming from the academy. I graduated, I've got my doctorate from NYU in cinema studies in 1977, and I wrote on a historical topic. Already by the late 70s and early 80s, most of the energy at the NYU cinema department was in critical theory. People there weren't terribly interested in the sort of historical context of different works that they were analyzing using various theoretical yardsticks. So all of that energy, or a large part of that energy, was going into theory and criticism. And what work was being done on the history of film was coming from well-trained amateurs. People like Kevin Brownlow, who was a filmmaker and a film historian, who was really responsible for turning attention onto silent films in a major way for the first time in many, many years. So what I thought I would do with this journal would be to try to link this, to have a bridge between the academy, sort of using the sort of rigorous, quote, rigorous and sort of academic contexts, rhetorical contexts, on one hand, and also looking at film as a medium with traditions and with cultural roots, a direction that at that time was largely being done by independent historians. So we established a board. I tried to establish a board which included people from all areas, people from universities, independent historians, also people who were curators of archives and museums, to bring them together and have a form and an approach to the history of film, which wasn't either a theoretical, analytical perspective that you might have gotten from a university, or one of these, and here's the guy who invented the first sprocket hole, and then, no, his letter to the editor, this fellow invented the first, and then, another letter to the editor, sort of wrangling about minutia of say, technological development.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Society for Cinema Studies conference, and I gave a little outline of this journal that was coming out. And from the back of the room, there was this one woman exclaimed, "At last, an empirical journal." I thought, you got it. You have it.
Richard, earlier in our interview, you described a little bit about what the associate editors do, and you've just mentioned the editorial advisory board and, you know, that you established one. Can you describe for our listeners, for a scholarly journal such as yours, just what does the editorial advisory board do?
Well, it differed over time. It differed over time when we were initially published by Taylor and Francis the first 5 years. The advisory board, which is a rather large number of people, were being barraged by me on a regular basis with, you know, solicitations for papers and ideas, and please look at this. And, that proved to be somewhat unwieldy, which is why when the journal was taken over by John Libby Publishing after about 5 or 6 years, we created from that, we extracted from that a smaller group of associate editors. And these associate editors and myself have, each of them independently, the responsibility of creating an issue. Now, I know in other journals you have a group of 5 or 6 editors and they sit around the table and they sort of thrash out among themselves the contents of every issue so that each of them is individually satisfied. I didn't know that that was going to lead to the most interesting kind of journal in our field. So while there is an overall direction, and I guess that direction comes down once somebody gets selected for one of these positions, once they are there, it's as if they were running their own magazine within the context of film history.
So they're essentially guest editors for that issue.
Yeah, they are the editors. But it's not guest editors because a guest editor would have sort of less authority or presence with the journal. These are people who keep coming back over and over again, so that their personality and their interests and their perspective will be ingrained in the journal from that point on. Otherwise, it would largely be my personality, which I guess would be okay for me, but I think this is a more interesting way of broadening out the appeal and sort of the range of areas of interest that the journal can cover.
How are the associate editors and the advisory board members compensated for their time and energy on the journal?
Well, they get subscriptions.
Uh-huh.
They do get subscriptions, and there is a fee. There is a small fee for the editing of an issue, so that when that comes up, you know. But this is largely a labor of love for the editors and as it is for the subscribers.
Some critics of the peer review process for scholarly journals in general, I don't mean film history, this is in general, have claimed that the work of editing a journal and being on the board isn't sufficiently compensated for the amount of time and energy that goes into it, specifically for rank and tenure in academic positions. Do you think that criticism is valid?
What do you mean by compensated? You mean financially?
No, not financially, just as a return in the rank and tenure process at whatever institution they may be working at.
Depends
that it
on
doesn't
the,
count as much.
Depends
as it
on the institution. It really depends on the institution, I think. Obviously, I think they should be, you know, rewarded tremendously, not only financially,
right,
but also in terms of respect and credit. Yes, is in your tenure packet, having edited a 175-page journal issue, given the same weight as having edited a 175-page book? Maybe not. maybe not. But on the other hand, the packet usually will include a sample of the work you've been doing. So I would hope that those who are reviewing your publication history would be able to take that into account.
Richard, before we close, I'd like to give you an opportunity to address aspects of film history I've not asked you about. Is there anything you would like to add?
Is there anything I would like? Well, in terms of the journal or the development of the medium itself?
Your choice.
Well, you know, maybe you can talk about the two of them simultaneously, because as I mentioned earlier, by 1980, there's very little historical work being done in the graduate cinema departments, at least in this country. And that has changed over time. Theory has, I don't want to say theory has proven a dead end, but there are a lot of people who used to do only theoretical work who were now writing for us. The change happened, I think, through the 80s and 90s, largely because of an increase in library and university resources, specifically large corporate and paper collections and private paper collections, which were deposited at places like the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Hoblitzel Theater Collection in Texas, UCLA on the West Coast. And these collections, some of which had arrived a few years earlier, were finally processed, and graduate students began to discover them. And they began to understand that you can see inside the walls of those Hollywood studios in the 1920s and 1930s, or what was going on in the, behind the scenes in Thomas Ince's production company, so that discussing the beginnings of motion picture history did not have to be limited to looking at a movie projected on a screen and trying to write about that or going through some old trade papers, but that you now had the opportunity to move behind that public facade and see how this art industry actually operated. And in the 90s, I think you saw a complete flip, complete change in the direction of the most creative energy in film studies towards new kinds of historical inquiry. And I think it was just a wonderful coincidence that we were here with this journal at the time that happened, because I can see it in the submissions over the past 20 years.
Richard Kozarski, thank you very much for being my guest on Periodical Radio.
Oh, it was great to talk to you. Thank you for asking.
You're very welcome. If you are interested in subscribing to Film History and International Journal, go to Indiana University Press's website. The URL is iupjournals.org/filmhistory. Be aware that there is a website titled Film History that is not affiliated with the journal. Thank you for listening to this installment of Periodical Radio. I'm your host, Steve Black.